So Gary, towards the end of the work, it's the accepting of the crown, and then you carry on from there.
Yeah.
If the work ever really ends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which it doesn't. It's always mm-hmm. an unfolding, right?
Yeah. And I think it's the ending here is a little dramatic.
Okay.
Dramatic?
Yeah. I mean, histrionic. It wasn't quite that bad.
The ending to this section?
Yeah, he's ending his life saying, oh, all I'm going to do is be alone for the rest of my life. He had tons of friends. He had an avid correspondent.
But no one that went through what he did.
No one that went through what he went, and he couldn't really turn to anyone else for help.
Right.
And he developed those friendships later.
At this point,
maybe he did this.
Right.
Except for
Tony. Right.
It's sounding a little like Nietzsche here. The lonely philosopher.
But when you're going through it, I remember early. I'm sorry, but you're going through all this shit by yourself. You don't know who to talk to. Then you find some therapist that sort of fill the bill. And until I found Jung and you and your classes, I did feel very, very much alone. It was really a lonely feeling. I mean, could not make progress beyond that until. So, anyway.
Thank you. Okay, so we're talking about the magic rod, or the black serpent rod. And then, and then he's told by Salome he's hanging too high, which I take to mean hoping to get away from the physical. Excuse me, the physical demands of the crown, you might say. As he says, a hanged king would like to change places with every blessed beggar on the country road who has not been hanged. That's pretty much that page, I think. Coming to grips with the crown. And then, I think we're dealing with that in-between stage where he kind of understands, and then it has to be driven home again. She says, hang till you understand. Next paragraph is important, I think. I remain silent and hang high above the ground on the swaying branch of the divine tree, for whose sake the original ancestors could not avoid sin. So that again tells me that's the tree of the Garden of Eden, and why I feel okay by saying the real issue here is sex and the spiritual meaning of Eros. My hands are bound and I'm completely helpless. I hang for 3 days and 3 nights, which I would take as a reference to Christ's crucifixion. Actually, it's 3 days and 2 nights, literally, but in the Bible it says 3 days and 3 nights in Matthew.
How long did Botan hang?
Nine.
Nine.
Yeah.
So 3 times 3.
3 times 3. Meaning to me that he is withdrawing his projection from Christ, that he is going through the crucifixion that Christianity tries to protect us from by allowing us to project it onto Christ. Now he then, for the next couple of paragraphs, he's wrestling with what's it mean. Love never ends, and love is the important thing. And those of you who did the Nietzsche stuff will recognize this flip flop within one paragraph. Next to the paragraph, I am weary.
Left column.
Left column, I am weary, weary, about halfway down. Here I am. I am weary, weary not only of hanging, but of struggling after the immeasurable. Then look 3 lines up from the bottom of that paragraph. He says, I could indulge in it forever. That's the nature of the unconscious. Two contradictory statements, almost within the same sentence. So he's flipping back and forth. I hate this, and I know it's important. Then the raven appears. Now, I had to think about that, because the raven is so important in Germanic mythology. It sits on the shoulder of Wotan. But I don't think that's what it's doing here. I think the raven here is just by virtue of the fact that it eats carrion. And Jung is thinking, I'm headed to be carrion. And it's, in that case, negative thinking.
Yeah, it's the bird of death in the Germanic cultures also. Right?
Yeah, it's bird of death, and then with Wotan, it's his one is his sight, and the other is his memory.
The raven.
The two ravens that sit on his shoulders, and they go flying out. So it's sort of like his mind that can go out and see everything. But see, there they're very positive, and here I don't think. It's the same.
For the Grail legend, the raven is sometimes associated with the dark aspects of the Grail quest. Sometimes it's associated with Arthur.
I'll have to check that.
And the raven's a blackbird.
I can't remember where I read that.
I'll see if it's in Emma Young.
Was that Merlin?
Change
back and forth. I don't know.
There might be more to it. I thought there was more to it, but the only thing I could figure out was the Wotan, and that didn't fit. But maybe it's a Grail reference.
I don't know. I can't even remember where I read that. It may not even have been in von Fromm's text.
I'll see. I'll check on it. Anyway, what it's doing is it's trying to instill doubt.
The raven.
I think so. Now, he tries to turn it into an intellectual discussion. It depends on your notion of love. And Jung says, basically, shut up. I'm going to go through it. I'm going to go through what it takes. No matter how you define it. And then the reference to magic. And then Satan appears at the bottom of the page. Now this is where it gets tricky, I think. Satan offers him to get down off the tree. And Satan says, essentially, in the third line in the second column, be inconsistent. See where I am. Now I take that to mean hide Tony Wolf. And the whole point of individuation is to see through our inconsistency. By inconsistency, I mean saying one thing and doing another, or doing two inconsistent things. Doing one thing one moment and one thing the next, and they're in conflict, and the way you deal with that is just to ignore it. So that would be life without the crown. And Jung is then fighting that thought. Give up. And then Jung calls on his white bird, which would be the confidence in his creativity. And then Satan says, you should be strong. And Jung says, no, I shouldn't. So here, strength would be the ability to be weak, to be strong enough to accept powerlessness in the name of the transformation process. I think this is another little quick detour, but you've heard me talk about this movie, which I'm kind of obsessed with. Woody Allen's movie about Paris. Yeah, I know some of you have seen it.
Midnight
in Paris.
Oh, yeah.
Well, at the end, you know, this love interest that he ends with, I thought, now who is that woman? So I looked her up. Her name is Léa Seydoux. And strange, she's a French actress, but her parents sent her to camp in Maryland every summer from the age of 10. Who sends kids from Paris to Maryland? I don't know. But so she knows America and she knows France. And she said, so, you know, from 10 years of age on, I grew up playing volleyball, baseball with these American girls. And so the interviewer said to her, what's the difference between an American woman and a French woman? And I don't think this just applies to women. It applies to the way we look at ourselves, period. She said, in America, it's important to present yourself always as in control, successful, doing well. She said, in France, it's just the opposite. It's important to show your vulnerabilities. Well, that was so insightful. And because Jung here is getting to the point where being vulnerable isn't a weakness. It's not a character defect. And, of course, it means a lot for him, but I just thought, it really said something to me, why I feel, in a way, more comfortable in Europe than I do here sometimes. Because you always, how are you doing? Great. You know, you can never say, well, I'm on a fucked up day. What? Oh, no. You know? But you can do that in Europe, you know. Yes, somebody, how they're doing, they'll tell you how they're doing. And the fact that she had stated it so clearly. Well, anyway, Jung is getting over that idea of strength as always having to appear, you know, in control and victorious. That he's allowing himself to be vulnerable so that this process can complete itself. And then he still is longing for the white bird, which would be to remind him or to support his understanding. Yeah, I'm going through this for the sake of creativity. You know, I think some of you heard me say that Gerhard Adler, you know, we did the Living Symbol. The first time he heard Jung lecture, he dreamt that Jung was crippled in one leg. I think that's the fact that dealing with the unconscious does lame us to a certain extent while opening us up to another dimension. So I hope my hope is with the white bird. Then the bird returns.
Returns?
Yeah. The bird, if you love the earth, you are hanged. If you love the sky, you hover. The bird is directing him back to the earth. And the bird says about 3/4 of the way down, the crown and serpents are opposites and are one. Did you not see the serpent, the crown, the head of the crucified, namely you? And that's that. It's just a back and forth of doubt and reaffirmation.
It's hard to think about them exactly as opposites.
Go ahead.
Well, you think of the crown as containing light and dark elements.
Yeah. I think what is going on here is that is being driven home to him. What you just said.
Oh.
Because I think he's still hoping, if I wear this crown, I don't have to pursue this experience.
But yeah, it does have that feeling.
Yeah, he's got it, but, you know, this is the way it works. You get it, and then you fight it. You get it, you fight it. You get it, you fight it. And that's what's going on now. Certainly at this age, remember, he's all of 38 years old or something like that now.
38, he's a baby, really.
Yeah, he's a baby, sure. Yeah. I think what I was like when I was 38, good God. And then more protests, starting there at 2 at the bottom. Whom did you carry to the mountains, you Kabiri? And whom have I sacrificed in you?
Before we go on,
yeah,
I can't really put together the idea that the mystery of the crown and the serpent is expressed in the writing on the crown that love never ends. And then immediately after that's revealed to him, he becomes very concerned about Salome. Why?
Because as I read this anyway, Carol, we're going to see pretty soon the issue comes up, love never ends, so what? Life is more important. And life includes Salome, where his traditional idea of love doesn't.
Okay.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, now we can accept this much easier, but he's realizing life is requiring adultery of him. And his Christian upbringing would say, well, that's not love. That's a sin. How can love be a sin? And this is what he's wrestling with.
So love never ends because love is a process. Can
you
say that?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Love never ends, but he's got to get through his head to accept the complications love is bringing him. This is what I think, anyway. And in that, the way he frames that is, I have to live the complications that love is bringing me. And, you know, probably at the time he's thinking, well, or let's look at it from Emma Jung's point of view. Probably at the time she's thinking, oh, so this is love? But later she said, clearly, he loved me more after he met Tony Wolf. He was able to love me more after he met Tony Wolf. So there you go. That's what he's struggling with now.
French woman can understand that better than an American woman, according to the definition of the actress, because the American woman has to be in charge and empowered and thinking of I'm on top of things and everything's got everything under control.
And even in that movie, sorry to keep harping on, but I'm just charmed by it. The hero asks. Actually, Carla Bruni, the time Sarkozy's wife, that's who plays the tour guide. Because in the movie, he's engaged, but he's met this other French woman he's fascinated with, and he says to to the Carla Bruni character. Now, do you think you can be in love with two women at the same time? She said, oh, yes. And he says, well, you French are a little ahead of us in that one. And she says, well, I think it was about Rodin. He loved one woman one way, and he loved the other woman another way. And he says, well, you French are a little ahead of us in that regard. But yeah, I mean, that's a little closer to the reality of life.
Well, you could pull it off, and Henry Murray couldn't.
Yeah. And I think Jung had a conscience. And
yeah. Henry Murray always struck me as being superficial.
Well, you want to tell us about Henry Murray?
Oh, I don't know enough about him. I read his biography, and I read her biography. Translate this dark dungeon.
Yeah.
And there's one about him, too. That's all I know. I mean, but he was clearly interested in his position as a proper Bostonian, and he married well. He wasn't about to give up that sinecure of marriage, nor his sinecure at Harvard. So he made rather minor, although significant contributions to American psychology with his. Perception.
Which was actually hers.
What?
Which was actually hers.
Yeah, right.
She was the brain behind that. Yeah.
And did all the drawings for it.
Yeah, he was a user.
He got credit for it.
Yeah.
You know,
what? You might remember that.
Yeah.
He took credit.
Is there anything in his biography about Herr Kuczynski? Sandy knew that Henry Murray was his psychologist, was doing research. Oh,
really?
And she met Kuczynski before he had a psychotic break or whatever he was a Harvard college graduate, mathematician, but yeah, right. But and of course he had a psychotic break. Well, but the insane one, you saw this. Right?
I saw it on TV.
Yeah, I've seen it too. Yeah.
And his after Ted Kaczynski was caught only because his family turned him in after agonizing deliberation. They found some work he had written and realized he was a unibomber. But he had a real traumatic experience as a child, which was they put him in the hospital for meningitis. And in that time, they didn't let the parents come near, they didn't go near him. And his mother said after that, it was a changed child. Well, then he went to Harvard and met Henry Murray. And
that was the Timothy Leary time, too. I wonder if he got involved with some of that stuff.
Well, no, I never even bothered that.
I'm sorry, didn't he do some kind of experiment on
him? Yeah, do you know the story? As I remember from there was a, what do you call it, frontline documentary on Kaczynski, in which they said that Henry Murray ran an experiment at Harvard, and it was to test the effect of losing your ideals. And he had graduate students, I think in English, maybe not, I don't remember the exact details, but graduate students write essays about what was important to them. And with the understanding that they would then discuss with a staff psychologist what they had written. That's the way it was presented. Now they assumed, I would think, that would be an entree into helping them understand themselves. Well, the real reality was they divided them up into two groups. And one group who had written essays was indeed discussed sympathetically what they had written with the staff. The other half, the staff tore down what they wrote and said everything that they wrote was shit. And Kaczynski was in that second group. So he had gone to Henry Murray's staff with an essay, and his ideals were torn down in this experiment.
I've heard about this, so I don't know whether I got it from you at some point, Gary, or whether I read it in the book, but it might have been in there. It might be in the fire here. Love Story Told or something like that. I think that's the name of the fire here.
And then, according to the TV show, which I think Frontlines tends to be reliable, it said Kaczynski was never the same afterwards.
And so that was a traumatic experience. Yeah. As a toddler, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, and his mother talked about that. His mother and his brother were on 60 Minutes. And, you know, they, of course, agonized over this, realizing what he was doing and what was their responsibility to their family members, to society, because I guess people had died as a result.
And were maimed.
And definitely maimed. My daughter read a account of this guy in the Air Force that wanted to be an astronaut. He was one of the ones that was injured by one of his bombs so badly he couldn't even fly. And I don't know about deaths, but I'm sure there were some. So what was their... What was their responsibility to agonize over that? Needless to say.
Okay. Bottom of the second column, 326. Whom did you carry to the mountain, you Kabiri? So that's a reference back to page 321, where Jung talks about his tower, I believe, being in the mountain. And we talked about it then, and I think it's okay. It's an image that his consciousness was raising above the collective. And then he says, and whom have I sacrificed in you? Now, the Kabiri are party boys in addition to being creative elements. So what I understood there is that he's had to sacrifice his he's had to sacrifice his Dionysian side to pull this off. And he thinks that he's going to live this inaccessible life in a tower. And probably at the moment, and for quite a while he did. Because remember, all his friends left him when he split from Freud. And then, I think indicating that we have gotten somewhere, the completion of the secret operation approaches.
Just quickly, when did he break with Freud?
1913, so about the time this whole thing started.
Right before.
Yeah.
Right, because he's...
Yeah.
He started this in fall 13.
Yeah. Now comes that bit, one can speak in beautiful words about love.
He talks about, right above that, he says, you have given birth to a cruel law.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think they indicate?
Well, what the creative task is demanding of him.
Oh, okay.
And then after the short paragraph, that what I was alluding to earlier, one can speak in beautiful words about love, but about life. And life stands above love. And then a little farther down I speak against the mother who bore me. I separate myself from the bearing womb. I speak no more for the sake of love, but for the sake of life. Remember in Symbols of Transformation, he talks about the hero separating from the mother. And here I think he's equating that to giving up, you might add, his traditional concept of love for life, which is requiring a more complicated understanding of love. But he feels his love is an act of betrayal. Right or wrong, that's how he feels it. Now, this next one puzzles me as well. The word has become heavy for me, and it barely wrestles itself free of the soul. Bronze doors have shut. I racked my brains what those bronze doors were. The only bronze doors I know, and this may be way far-fetched, are the baptistry in Florence. Is that what you thought?
Yeah.
Which really was a baptistry. So I could read into this that the Christian idea of salvation is closing for him. Now that may be far-fetched. I don't know any other bronze doors. Again, why am I harping on sex and affairs and eros? Well, not the power of the flesh, but of love, should be broken for the sake of life. He puts the flesh at the top.
What? What do you mean he puts the flesh at the top?
Not the power. It's not.
Oh, because he doesn't break it. Okay.
Yeah, you can break love, but you can't break the flesh. That's what I get him saying.
He's saying there that traditional love with its traditional fidelities can and should be broken.
I don't know if I'd say should, but sometimes may have to be broken if the power of the flesh demands it. That's a strong statement, I think. And that's what I would cite to justify the angle I've taken to this whole book.
Well, he definitely highlights the relationship between child and mother, which is true in his psychology. That
yeah.
has to be broken, so to speak.
Yeah.
That last sentence in that paragraph, love seeks to have and to hold its ownership and power.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's been his psychology all along, but life once more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe as you had pointed out, by the end of Mysterium, by the end of Memories, in his kind of eulogy to love, he's got a broader understanding that love and life can work together, but at this point, he feels that love requires betrayal and that betrayal is necessary in the face of what life demands, namely his creative work.
Well, the bronze doors, well, the first effect of them, I get the baptistry connection too, but is that you could have said iron doors would have been an equivalent statement that he's had to harden himself, he's had to deny love and steel himself. Put iron barriers against love so that he can live life, or his concept of life, which is a little bit brain-directed. I mean, it's not. I mean, it's a concept. It's built for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might, in the light of our discussions, you might always preface my current idea of love.
Yeah,
I think that would
or
be
life.
Fair. Yeah.
Even life, his current idea of life. I mean, mm-hmm. he hasn't fully defined either of them. So he's hardening himself he's taking a position
mm-hmm.
in order to survive. I mean, I can really do that. Okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take this action. This is my will of the moment.
Yeah. And later in his life, I think he used the phrase faithless eros.
You ever come across that? Faithless.
You have to have a faithless eros. In other words, to really commit yourself, sometimes you have to betray eros, let's say for the wife. But it's done for a higher purpose.
Being faithful to life.
Being faithful to life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just very simple. I remember when I was going off to college, my dad said to me, you know, sometimes you have to hurt the people you love the most. Meaning my separation from my mother. I think that's the idea that we think love and kindness go together, but they don't always go together. And what the mother's son can't do is hurt somebody in the name of a higher love or of life. So that's how I would understand that.
Mother's son meaning the one who's still subordinate.
Still subordinate to the mother, yeah.
But that pain that's felt by both
yeah.
child and mother opens the door for a greater life for both.
Yeah.
It really is a setting free
yeah.
for the mother and the child.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel that way.
Doesn't feel that way, no.
It was so good to go through it with my daughter so strongly, and then when my son went off to his own life, it was so much easier to,
because mm-hmm.
I knew what the process was all about.
Mm-hmm.
But with my daughter, it was so much more hurtful to the letting go.
Mm-hmm.
But it does set you free.
But then, to life. Again, there is the girl travel versus the boy travel. I think there's a different way they handle it.
And my daughter was much meaner.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, well, and
she was meaner.
Oh my God!
I think she had that.
Wow.
That was the only time we ever really had a tough time. Her teenage years, you know, she was a good kid, a good student, whatever. But she came home from college, and it was, you know, we went through it, but we talked about it. You don't have to be so mean in order to be yourself. And finally she got it.
Famous last word.
No, it's true. But yeah. my son, he wasn't like that.
Yeah, you probably had learned. Huh?
He was like, I'm going to be who I am, and this is who I am. And
mm-hmm.
he didn't like it or not.
Boy, that's an enormous accomplishment. You know, how many guys mm-hmm. stumble over that moment mm-hmm. and never resolve it? Mm-hmm.
Maybe her meanness was her bronze doors.
Well, yeah, she needed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She definitely needed to shut the door because the dependency on me was way too strong. Yeah. But then it was painful. It's painful to let that go. For both.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure eventually letting go of Tony Wolf was very painful for
yeah.
them both,
mm-hmm.
but it's letting free.
Yeah, I think it must have been terrible because I don't think she ever really had a life after that. I mean, she was an analyst, but how is the feeling?
You don't hear anything.
You don't hear much about her. She lived a kind of quiet, reclusive life, lonely. That's my guess. That must have been very hard. You know, Jung had a heart, and he must have felt that.
It almost sounds, from what Nina told us about her reaction to alchemy, is that she no longer fulfilled his needs as an anima. I mean, she was not, you know, the fallen spirit trees in the direction he needed to go.
Yeah.
And there may have been other dimensions to that, too.
No, I think it's that simple. According, was this Berrigan, maybe, that... No, this is me putting two and two together. He had mentioned that she was apparently from one of these old Zurich families. And, you know, I don't think we grasp what an old European family is. You probably do with your, you know, European appreciation, Carl. But it's just, you just don't step outside the line. And they were very established. And as he said, you couldn't think a thought that hadn't been established for 1,000 years. and that's what she was representative of, and what he collided with in her, or where they collided.
Yeah, obviously she went along with a lot of thoughts.
Yeah.
For a while that hadn't been ever represented before, and so maybe it just had to be too much.
It might not could be.
I love the next line.
Yeah.
The beginning of all things is love. The being of things is life.
Yeah. This is some beautiful stuff here. Mm-hmm. This distinction is terrible. O spirit of the darkness depths, do you force me to say that whoever loves does not live, and whoever lives does not love? Now, I think that's the devil, the spirit of the darkest depths, and he's trying to get straight. I can love and live at the same time, and something in him is saying, no, you can't. Now this where it gets a little confusing, I think. He starts, as I read this, will there be a sea where Philemon's temple stands? Will the shady island sink? In other words, am I losing everything? And then we'll see, just in the next column, he starts cursing Philemon. But I would take that second column as a momentary reaction against what he feels he has to go through.
Well, does a figure actually appear here?
No, he's sort of speaking in his mind.
You don't think a sun actually appears?
Or
some of the frogs?
Well, yes. Hang on a second. No, I think that son of the earth is the devil.
It seems like there are two sons, because
there's a later son. It's a different
son. There's a son of the earth, and then there's I don't know.
Well, to get this, maybe we'll look at it. We'll come back to it next week. But if you remember Zarathustra, how so many contradictory thoughts can go through your head at the same moment in one sentence, certainly one paragraph, and what we have to do that moment is go through each one and say, this is valid, this isn't.
Well,
this is valid. Yeah.
Now, this son is not the devil himself, because he says, you're no son of mine, but a spawn of the devil.
But it's the devilish voice.
Yes, but not the devilish
voice. And he can't trust it.
Right. Then he talks about the father of the devil. Wouldn't that be God?
Let me see, where does that come?
Well, I'm getting ahead of us a little bit.
Yeah.
That's on the second column.
This is terribly confusing because he's confused. That's why it's confusing. In alchemy, this is the mass of confusion. And most of us are spared this, but if you ever have found yourself deeply depressed and agitated, this is the way your thoughts work. Mm-hmm. You have about 10 different thoughts in the same paragraph, and he's just letting it fly. And what we have to do is go back and assess each sentence. This is trustworthy. Here's what he really means. This is not trustworthy. This is what he could be trying to say.
But that letting it fly is really important.
That's important.
Because, you know, if a person enters into a process like this thinking, well, things are going to be logical one after another, I mean, this is him living it out for us, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think it's really valuable.
Yeah. Well, it helps me. I mean, and you can, when you get feeling shitty and you think like this, don't think you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
This is the nature of the process. At any level of depth, you're inundated with doubt and resentment and hurt and loneliness, and within 1 second it can flip that you feel on top of the world, and that's the way the process goes.
Yeah, he does such a good job of writing about that chaos.
Yeah. And I think this is why, one of the reasons why his work is not accepted, because nobody wants to go through this.
You feel bipolar. Like,
yeah.
Well, and it's not an experiment. You can repeat exactly.
And it can't be, it discombobulates the linear mind.
Mm-hmm.
The figure that he comes up with, the king of the earth, the bug-eyed frog that wears pond weed on the skull's pate, that's further extensions of this devil. Right?
I think so.
But then he momentarily can projects that onto Philemon, it seems, in the next paragraph.
Or he looks at Philemon from that devil's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Or he accuses Philemon of causing that...
Yes.
...that devil to inseminate his soul, and that son of the frogs,
yeah,
is that result.
Or he sees it, heaven as goddamn Philemon. I wouldn't be in this mess. And so, screw you, Philemon, and I'm going to tell you how I feel about it. But that's the devil's voice speaking. But that's the way it works. And you never go through this process without those thoughts. The trick is you can't identify with them. If you identify with them, you're sunk. Because what the voice is saying is everything you've done up to now is worthless. But this is part of the process. This great resentment against everything you've wanted to accomplish, have accomplished, because it's hard. And why can't you just retire to the Florida Keys and just have a happy life forever? Yeah.
That's boring.
But boring. And, you know, I've never retired to the Florida Keys, but when I was in Zurich in the summers, I would, when I had spare time, go to they have a beach that surrounds the city. And, I mean, this is a place where the rich and famous would summer. And what you find, these people that are living this great life are so dull. They have nothing interesting in their lives. Everything is pleasure and ease. They can't think about anything. Their relationships are terrible. That temptation back to paradise leads to stagnation. Yeah. Well, let's see. Where should we say? Should we pick up with this again?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say we'll pick up with... Well, let's pick up with Not the Power of Flesh and Love, just to review. And I think we kind of gotten over to the end of the Philemon dialogue, but we can go through that more closely,
mm-hmm.
I think. So I had you read to the end. What have we got left? Well, not much left. You might get through this next time. The scrutinies are, I'm going to say, read ahead. Now, the scrutinies over to the bottom of, the scrutinies over to the bottom of the second column on 334, is just a diatribe of self-critical attack. We won't spend much time on that, so you can read through that. You might, just in case we get on a roll, very doubtful, but say read over to 336, right before 3. See where I am? Now, we're going to have to see how the scrutinies go. I don't know. They don't seem nearly as emotionally demanding as what we have done, but they are reflections on what we have done. So maybe we'll go fast, maybe we'll go slow. I don't know. It could be we'll speed up, it could be we won't speed up. But they're not as image heavy. They're thoughts about what he's just been through. And they're his thinking trying to come to grips with what he's just seen. And that's it, and thank you for hanging in.
Still hanging.
Well, if we go at a regular pace, I figure it will be not till the November, December of next year we get through. If we go fast on the scrutinies, we'll go faster. But yeah, this is the biggest thing we've ever done, and the hardest.
Yeah.
And it's cost me sleep.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I want to understand it.
Well, its value is phenomenal.
It's phenomenal.
Beyond,
yeah.
Beyond the class.
Yeah.
To take it into your own work and working with other people.
Yeah.